Good morning. I'm going to call this House of Representatives State Government Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 1st, 2025. Let's dispense with the minutes if I can get someone to make a motion. Representative Sexton.
So moved.
Representative Sexton moves the minutes from March 27, 2025. All in favor? Those opposed? That was enthusiastic. Minutes are approved. Okay, today we have a reasonably full agenda. We've got two presentations from constitutional officers.
This might work.
Auditor Blaha is...
might have figured this out.
He's figuring out technology.
This might be working.
Okay. So, Madam Auditor, welcome to the committee. Apparently technology is your April Fool's Day joke.
It is. It is. I just, my computer was nice enough to update right as we go, so I just need to get my slideshow up here. If okay. I can find that. Slideshow. Okay. Oh, goodness. It's asking me all of my options. I'll show that again. All right. So, almost there. Luckily, I think I can talk a little bit faster and catch us all up.
Well, Madam Auditor, you and I have known each other since the time that you started in office. I know you can talk.
Thank you. I will take that for the compliment. I'm sure it is.
It is. You have the gift of gab, as do most of us.
Okay, let's see what happens here. It might be a little bit reduced today,
right,
but
please
I think it'll still be effective.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Julie Blaha. I'm your state auditor. Excited to be here with you today. I am also joined by Matt Lindemann, who is our operations director, for any specifics, particularly on our budget. So to start out, now, I thought you'd be okay if I maybe dispense with a couple of things. We'll just very briefly talk about what we do. We'll talk a little bit about what we've done, and then we'll talk about what's coming up next. So as many of you know, our main role is fiscal oversight. We oversee about $40 billion in local government activity. And then we have now, in the last couple of years, we have picked up the statewide single audit. So it's the audit of the federal funds at a certain level that go through state government. And it used to be done by the legislative auditor, and they, I think, looked at both capacity and focus and decided to move that off. We do a lot of single audits, so it's kind of our thing. So it was really exciting to be able to pick that up. And that deadline, by the way, was yesterday, and we made it. So thanks to all the people at the and all the state agencies that helped us make sure we hit that deadline. All right, basically, what we do in our office, to sum it up, is basically three things. We have examinations, like audits, legal compliance, and investigations. We do analysis, including collecting data, reports. We have comparison tools. We are now, of course, adding dashboards where you can check your compliance level. We also provide basic training, accounting tools. CTOS might be something you're familiar with. And then we also do a lot of one-on-one support as well, and have seen quite an increase in that lately, particularly with the shortages. If you're okay, we're going to skip over all of these divisions and kind of get right into our budget. Let's get right to the budget. And so, Mr. Chair, if it's your pleasure, I'd like to turn it over to Matt Lindemann.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Matt Lindemann. I'm the Finance Director for the Office of the State Auditor. So if you take a quick look at the OSA's budget, it shows that approximately 85% of the OSA's budget is dedicated to paying staff salaries and benefits. Most of our budget is recovered by fees and other sources. Audit fees are based on actual costs of conducting those audits. The OSA budget is less than 5%, is less than 0.05% of the state's budget. So from there, we're just going to move on into our budget requests.
Well, before we do that, just want to talk a little bit about I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Madam Auditor.
Thank you. About kind of what we've done since the last time we talked, I do want to thank you all for, in the last session, we were able to make some significant improvements due to the work that you all did. So what we have done in, we had four changes to our budget. We, in our operations area, we increased administrative support, which also helped us decrease vacancies, as well as really has helped us find a way to get a lot of things done with staff that both specializes it and also has a bit of a lower cost. We added a township specialist, as we are trying to support townships, particularly ones that struggle to get their reporting in, that are really being hit hard by public finance staff shortages and other shortages in the finance sector. Special investigations, we are adding two special investigators, which is particularly timely because the number of requests to us has gone up sharply. Sometimes these are requests that we can very quickly dispense with. They might not be, they might be rumors, they might be, frankly, conspiracy theories. We can dispense with those, put some people's mind at ease, but it is taking additional time. And so our additional, particularly our additional administrative staff, has been a lifesaver in that space. Technology, you all know about our technology from the last meeting that I was here. We have added IT staff and a new chief information officer, and again, making significant improvements there. Okay, and the compliance dashboards also that we have added, as well as improving CTOS. Particularly in CTOS, our city-town accounting system, basically QuickBooks for small government, we particularly increased security with additional encryption. It was a big part of that change. Other things that we have done new, we have a group called the Audit and Reporting Group, ARG. I'm happier about that than everyone else, but this is why there's a ship and sometimes an eye patch. But what we're doing is, what we've seen is that there's quite a patchwork in the oversight of local government. And in a time when we have a shortage, our goal is to really focus and find a way to deliver the accountability that Minnesotans deserve and are expecting and have right to expect, while dealing with changes in the workforce. And so it's a group of public, of private sector auditors from the big audit firms that do state government. We have state officials, we have our team, and we have local government officials, and we're coming up with a lot of things. Fun fact, any bill you're seeing going through right now that changes a threshold for an audit for local government, by the way, I believe there are two right now, and we both think that they're very workable. In fact, we'll likely be testifying on those if they come up. We also, in that process, we've been building new tools to help you do your work. One of the things we're working on is a threshold calculator, so you know the impact of your thresholds if you're going to change them. Not just what the number is, but also how much effect it has on the entire system. Also, this last year was quite a bit of oversight of us, frankly. We had our peer review, which is when your colleagues come in and check your audit practices, got the highest rating that we can get on that. And we even reduced the number of small verbal findings that we've had. We also conducted an efficiency review. Because of the funding that we had, we were looking to see which tools we could find to increase our efficiency. So we were reviewed by an outside firm on how we do our audits. And we talked about timing and all of that. As a result, we were able to find tools and do some things that means we will not necessarily spend all of our funds that you accounted to us, allotted to us. And in fact, some of that will be coming back to the general fund because we were able to find some lower cost ways to achieve the same goals on that. All right. Okay, our change item goals. You see the change items that we put forward in October, which is when they are due, as you know, a couple forecasts ago. Just to tell you what our thinking was for the things that you saw in our ask, we need to continue essential oversight and respond to a national public finance staff shortage. This is probably the most important statistic that you hear thrown about nationally, is right, 75% of all certified public accountants could retire today, literally today. And we do not have people coming up to fill all those roles. So we are going to need to look at a variety of things to deliver, again, the oversight you all deserve while dealing with this workforce shift. And so what we were looking at are things like, of course, our operating adjustment, which keeps us where we are. Also would mention, well, we used to be 21% behind when adjusted for inflation of where our office was back in 2000. We're at 8% now. So we, again, you closed the gap quite a bit in the last session. Still a gap, though. We also were talking about things like trainers, IT auditors, and, of course, getting our data in a place that can be used more effectively by AI, machine learning, all of that. You see a similar thing in, I think, the governor's fraud package, the idea of going to some putting our system in a set of data warehouses. Now, but we also understand that you all have a lot of tough decisions to make. So I thought we might want to just get right to just how we calculated that, and I think you'd probably be okay if we simply focus on our operating adjustment as we discussed today. So, Matt Lindemann.
Chair, if you look at our budget, our operating adjustment, the net cost would be $486,000 for the biennium and would protect 14.5 positions.
So, again, the idea of having trainers was so that we could widen the pool of applicants. We'd be able to train our own and get more people in the door and be able to aid in both attraction, retention, and support local government officials that are really also struggling with shortages. The biggest asks we're getting right now are trainings. Now, I know you all know how exciting TIFF is, but you can't believe just how much we've almost doubled our TIFF training numbers, people coming to that, not just for the fun of it. We also, when we're looking at, again, the data warehouse to avail ourselves of machine learning to be able to increase efficiency, and the IT auditors is because regular financial audits have had significantly increased portions that are based on IT. They're not like the IT audit we just had, that the OLA conducted, but there is more in a regular financial audit. And of course, though, we do know you're making some tough decisions. So our top priorities are, first, operating adjustment. That keeps us from going backward. That keeps us moving forward. And we can figure it out with that operating adjustment. Also, apart from that, any place where you can increase pay for particularly in our office, it's MAPE, MMA, AFSCME members are our three big bargaining units. That will be huge. We are constantly struggling with make an offer, the person's excited to take the job, and someone comes in and poaches them with more money. And that's all there is to it. We do have some other flexibilities that make our office particularly attractive. Work-life balance, great mission. If I could look right at a camera, the OSA is a wonderful place to work. But I'll tell you, any time that we can increase those salaries, that would make a huge difference for us as well. I would rather have to figure out how to deal with higher salaries than try to figure out how to fill vacancies with lower salaries. And so with that, we will be more than happy to have further discussion on whatever topic you'd like on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Auditor. Members, questions? Representative Sexton.
Good morning, ma'am. Very good presentation this morning. Thank you for coming down and informing us. You've asked for a budget increase. Are you also increasing any of your fees to the cities and counties with the services you provide?
Madam Auditor.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair. Great question. We have not had to increase fees for 3 years, I believe it was. However, with increased pay, it will need to be increased. That's primarily driven by salaries. And we don't have the option to, like, set it in a way that we appreciate. We have to set it exactly based on what the cost is, and that is also then audited by Minnesota Management and Budget. And then we do charge right down to the hour and to the person. So a newer person, that hour is charged to that person's cost. And so, yes, that price, the cost will be going up. It will not be rising at the same rate that we've seen in the private sector, but it will still impact our local governments. Yes.
Representative Sexton.
Can you give us an idea, maybe a percentage-wise, how much a small town of 30,000 would see as far as an increase in their audit?
Madam Auditor?
Thank you. Another good question. One of the things is that we really don't have very many small entities. We have primarily counties, The smaller entities also are more likely to be doing another kind of examination engagement, like an agreed upon procedures or something like that, depending on their size and structure. As far as a cost increase, we won't know that yet. We're calculating it right now. But again, not as high as in the private sector, but still, I think it will be something they'll notice. A couple thousand, what do you think? Yeah, and also, that's one of the reasons, too, we're working so hard on efficiency. We'd love to be able to drop the number of hours we need, not only just to get more done, but also to keep costs down as well. We've seen, for instance, a pretty good drop in hours for the statewide single audit, simply because we're getting better at it.
Representative Sexton, anything further?
Can we get a follow-up letter or
some you bet.
Sort? Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation today, and as we see an increase coming, my question will be, you know, you talk about collective bargaining and kind of what we got going on or like your employees. What will your percentage be on the paid family leave for your total staff?
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Nash, Representative Joy. I know that because we got a fiscal note request on it last year. For us, it really doesn't make a change. Because of the contracts that we're working with, we've already been providing those same things, and the tracking is not really unreasonable for us. So we don't expect to see really any cost impact because all of our staff basically already have those benefits.
Representative Joy.
So your staff already has like the 12 weeks off, or they're already paying in, and when they're off, they get 60% of their salary, or they have all that already to meet that criteria. Not the ESST, but the paid family leave. It's going to start.
Again,
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Again, I can follow up with more detail on that. Don't have top of my head, but my understanding is, again, we are not expecting an impact from that because it's simply we already have our own HR person, so we already know how to track it, and we don't anticipate having an issue with that. To be honest, also, we are just running a lot of overtime, frankly. People are spending putting a lot of extra time in. We are not getting a lot of extra leave also.
Representative Joy. Co-Chair Cleburne. I did not see any.
Thank you. I would like to know just about the CTAS program.
Yes.
Because I think to Representative Sexton's question about fees to cities for audits and it being your response that it's based on time and things like that, did you feel that the CTAS is helpful to those smaller communities to expedite their audits and things like that?
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Yes, in fact, we very recently had a call, someone asking about the cost of their audit. Now, it was not an audit we perform, but they're saying, wow, this audit is $15,000, and we only have about $150,000 in our whole budget. And one of the things that we suggested was start, and their own private auditor suggested, is why don't you start on CTAS? Because it keeps you organized and it is directly connected to the rules in Minnesota. CTAS will only work in Minnesota. Iowa asked for it. I had to tell the Iowa state auditor, I'd love to give it to you, but it won't work for you. Because it's tailored to our statutes. But that can reduce the cost of your audit by making sure you're better prepared and it's organized in a way that saves your auditor time. So we've seen there are a lot of cost savings there. In addition, with reporting to us, the reporting that's required by the legislature, it's a one button situation. If you're on CTAS, you can just push that button and it pulls it together and reports it to us. So it will save you hours internally. It will also save your auditor time, as well as simply just cutting down errors and increasing transparency, which I think also is great for the public.
Thank you.
Leroy, anything further?
Yeah, just one last thing. I'd like to know about the dashboard because we made a significant investment in the dashboard also. Have our counties and municipalities found that to be a helpful tool?
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you. To the point that they're asking for more. That is what we're seeing right now. It is set up so you can have that moment at 4 a.m. and you're thinking, oh, did I get my TIF stuff in? And you can go to our site and check it. You also can check your community, you can check your neighbors, and have a chance, where are we in compliance? And so I've seen, you know, things like fire relief associations where the last couple of years we have not had to nobody's had to lose fire state aid because they filed on time. We got everybody done with less effort on our end as well. So we are seeing some benefit there, again, to the point that people would like are asking for more.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kwan, we skipped you before we went to Chair Cleburne, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are somewhat related. How much misuse and fraud have you found? How much funds have you been able to assist in gaining back? And since you took over the audits of the federal stuff, how much clawback has the federal government done with Minnesota?
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Representative Kwan, Chair Nash. All those are really interesting questions. I don't know if I can calculate them off the top of my head. But as far as fraud, again, I'm thinking of the fraud that we have seen the last, you know what, I can't add it up in my head quick. I can get it to you, though. Okay. Things like finding, embezzlement and good thunder and a lot of what we've actually been working on in our investigations area are a lot of questions conflict of interest. And we spend a lot of time looking at conflict of interest. And what we're actually finding is most of the time we'll do our investigation and we're finding that what we're seeing in this government entity is legal. And so I think any conversation you all want to have about conflict of interest, I think what people's expectation of what the rules are and what the rules actually are quite different. So as a result, a lot of the things we've investigated lately have not yielded fraud, but have actually yielded that the issue was not there. As far as the federal government and as far as clawbacks, that wouldn't necessarily show up on our audit. And so one of the things I can tell you is we have seen some trends in the federal single audit of improvement on the main areas of concern, frankly, across the country, particularly in the area of subrecipient monitoring. And I would love to come and, you know, and one of the things that we may want to do is have us come and testify and walk through the trends we're seeing in the single audit. Since we took that over, we do walk through those trends with department heads to talk about what we're seeing on there. So we're seeing some progress. I think it's because we do, you know, findings come up every year and you keep checking them until they are gone. But as far as clawbacks, that wouldn't necessarily show up in our work.
And Auditor Blaha, in the interest of time, maybe we can make sure that you get Representative Kwan's questions so that you can maybe provide a letter back to the committee.
Sure.
So just one quick question for myself before we move on to the AG. I think we had asked at one time how many open job recs that you have. Just wanted to get an update on where that was as of today.
Thank you, Chair Nash. As of today, let's see here. Well, we just had to we have to repost for the investigators. They got higher offers, and so they were excited until they saw more money somewhere else, and so we're reposting that of the new positions. That's all that is open at this point. We just had a retirement. But we just brought on some people. I'd have to give you an update as of today. It's improved since our letter, but we still have ways to go.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Auditor, because as we move forward, we'll have to look at all the things that are going to be in or not in the finance bill. So if you could copy Chair Cleburne and I on an email and maybe our respective staff so that we can have that knowledge as we move forward.
Certainly.
If you had a brief closing statement, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Again, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And again, if you want any more information, I'm so excited to nerd out with you on this issue. I'd be happy to come in and have a long conversation about all of our audits. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on the agenda, we have Attorney General Ellison, if he would make his way to the testifiers table with staff. Welcome to the committee. If you would, introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation. And just to be, we didn't get a presentation. Was one submitted? Okay. Very good. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and co-chair. It's an honor to be in front of the committee again today, and I thank you for your time. Let me just dive right into it. First, a very quick overview of what the core functions of the Attorney General's office does. First, the Attorney General represents more than 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions in litigation and in other legal matters. Second, the Attorney General plays an important role in criminal prosecution, both in supporting county attorneys with criminal prosecution and appeals on their request and in sharing original jurisdiction over Medicaid fraud. Third, the Attorney General serves on several state boards, including the Executive Committee, the State Board of Investment, and the Board of Pardons. And fourth, and finally, the Attorney General is the chief enforcer of Minnesota's consumer protection, antitrust, and charities laws. We have about over 400 talented employees. About 40% of them are attorneys. The remainder are legal assistants, investigators, mediators, and financial analysts that support our staff. All of us are working together to fulfill the charge of the office per the Constitution and state statutes. Our general fund budget is approximately $40 million per fiscal year, with about 82% of that going to compensation and salary for workers. I want to thank the legislature for your investment in our office. Our ability to strengthen our team has helped us deliver for the people of the state of Minnesota. In the 20 years before I was sworn in as Attorney General in 2019, the office saw a reduction in budget, even as our state's population increased, as society became more litigious, and the challenges facing consumers became more complicated. The funding we received in 2023 helped us to hire about 26 new legal staff who have made dramatic contributions to our office. I'd like to highlight a few areas, but this is not an exhaustive list. As you know, original jurisdiction for most criminal prosecution in Minnesota lies with county attorneys. We have a county attorney system, and they are elected in our 87 counties. However, Minnesota Statute 8.1 provides that when and only when county attorneys request it, the attorney general may take over prosecution of a criminal case from a county attorney. Also, the governor may appoint the attorney general's office to take over any criminal prosecution. The attorney general's office maintains a division called the criminal division to help with these requests. Historically, it has been the county attorneys in greater Minnesota who have smaller staffs who requested this help, and we've been able to step in those critical times, given that we prosecute maybe 30, 40 murders every year, and some counties never see one within about 4 or 5 years. And then, of course, there's legal conflicts. And so we are the prosecutor of last resort and are well-trained and able to help local counties when they need it. Beginning in 1999, however, the attorney general began decreasing his capacity to assist county attorneys with criminal prosecution. So by the time I became attorney general in 2019, the division was down to one full-time and one part-time prosecutor. This was a big concern to the counties as I talked to them, which I do regularly. We had a high back in before 1999 of 12 full-time prosecutors, and this meant that the assistance they were able to provide county attorneys was limited to only homicide cases, and that the office routinely was unable to accept cases, which created problems because counties then had to turn to other counties to do complicated cases and to do cases where they were not staffed, when it's really the attorney general's job to do that. So when I ran for attorney general on a pledge to restore the criminal division to full strength and be a better partner to our county attorneys, especially in greater Minnesota, using existing resources, I was able to boost the number of full-time prosecutors from 1.5 to 3, but we still were not able to meet the demand that counties had. So as a result, I requested more resources from the legislature that was granted in 2023, and now we have 9 new staff for the division, and they're all very busy working with counties all over the state, mostly in smaller counties, but from time to time we do appeals for nearly all counties except for the largest ones. So I'm pleased to report that with the assistance in 2023 and 24, we have more than doubled the new cases per year. This is tremendously important for our counties. Criminal prosecutions, particularly for homicide, are expensive and place a significant burden on our counties and create a real problem when it comes to the administration of justice. So the cases that we do, again, homicide, criminal sexual assault, child pornography, drug overdose cases involving deaths, and even wage theft cases. So in the past 6 years, we've been able to take cases for county attorneys in 40 different counties in every corner of the state. So the Attorney General's Office has the authority to enforce both state and federal antitrust laws, where we've been busy in this area, to protect competition in the marketplace, benefit consumers, and maintain, you know, fair wage competition among employers. When I was first elected, the office had a very small antitrust section, one or two people working on it occasionally. The legislature has allowed us to increase to two additional antitrust attorneys, and it has turned and it has increased our division. We made it into a division, and now we've increased the size of the office so that we can take on some of the most challenging mergers, acquisitions, and anti-competitive transactions in our state. Examples of the work includes things like a lawsuit against John Deere. My office, along with the Illinois AG and the Federal Trade Commission, sued John Deere over its unfair practices that have driven up equipment costs to repair in farmers in Minnesota and around the country. The lawsuit alleges that for decades, Deere's unlawful practices have limited the ability of farmers and independent repair providers to repair Deere equipment. And, of course, Deere has a substantial and dominant position in the market. And so we're pursuing that. We also created a wage theft unit, which has been able to return about $2 million back to workers whose wages have been stolen from them. We also have an example of the work has to do with Evergreen Acres, a dairy farm that stole over $3 million of wages from their workers and had workers living in abysmal conditions. We sued, won back significant pay, and restored adequate living conditions for the workers who worked there. Contributing to the state, I'd like to talk about what we do for the state in terms of financial sustenance. Our office's mission is to help Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. Over the past 6 years, we've protected the state of Minnesota and its many residents from harm. In that time, we've contributed $2.1 billion to the bottom line of our state and to Minnesota households. This number far exceeds the legislature's total appropriation to the Attorney General's office over that time. Over the past 4 years, the office has returned $40 million to the state's general fund in the form of revenue and deposits from undisbursed restitution funds. The office has further contributed significant amounts to dedicated funds. For example, we have reached a total of $565 million in settlements with opioid companies. $183 million of that amount has already been received. My office has also won an additional $81 million for the state's tobacco fund, and recent judgment that the state may be owed up to $58 million more, plus interest, by successfully litigating against tobacco companies for not paying the state the full amounts they agreed under Minnesota's historic 1999 tobacco settlement. We won more than $60 million for the state in our settlement with Juul and Altria over their deceptive e-marketing of cigarettes to youth. This was the largest per capita settlement of any of the states who sued Juul. The amounts I just mentioned are dollars that we've contributed to the state. We've also contributed significantly to the bottom line of Minnesota households. This has taken many forms, but the highlights include $1.5 billion in utility costs that electric and natural gas consumers save because of the intervention and advocacy of the Residential Utilities Division of the Attorney General's Office. This work we do pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 8.33, along with our representation of the Department of Commerce in these matters. We've turned more than $85 million in restitution and debt relief that the office has won for Minnesotans victimized by student loan scams. Our office, our Consumer Action Division, has returned $51 million directly to Minnesotans' pockets over the last 6 years by helping consumers informally mediate and resolve thousands of complaints that we receive from the public every year. We've received about 65,000 calls per year, and we respond to all of them for the people of the state of Minnesota. I'm very proud of this work. The investment from the legislature has been a big part of that. We're grateful to you. And that's why for the last several years, the Minnesota Attorney General's Office is the only Attorney General's Office in the United States to receive multiple USA Today Top Workplace Awards. We have a high degree of morale because people are mission-driven and work hard every day. Let me just say in the spirit of openness that we look forward to talking with you one-on-one or as a group, as you choose. Thank you. My associate, Laura Sales, is here to help me answer any questions. And, of course, we'd be more than happy to respond if we don't have the answers right here.
Thank you, AG Ellison. I do have at least one member question. Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, when you spoke to the committee right after you started, just previously to your starting, there was a issue where the AG refused to defend a state law, and several counties were sued. And those counties won, but the legislature had to then pay for the legal fees. Have there been any other instances of where your office has declined a request by, a county, a city, agency to defend Minnesota state law?
Mr. Chairman?
Before, if I could, Representative Quam, are you talking about the lawsuit from the prior state auditor? Yes. Just wanted to make sure that I saw the confusion. Just wanted to make sure that I understood the question before we answered. A.G. Ellison.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what lawsuit you're referring to. I certainly don't remember the case that you're talking about. Can you give me a name or citation so that I could respond to you directly?
Representative Quam.
Actually, you responded when you the first time you were before a legislative committee. When you started, it was the Attorney General was suing several counties because we had a state law that allowed options for some entities to seek other entities to audit them than the Attorney General. But I guess offline, when you can look at that, the other things I'm curious about is, and this will be offline as well, what is the average cost of external lawyers? Because I know there have been examples where there have been annual average cost, and then the annual average cost and unsuccessful challenges to the federal government. And then lastly, what is the success rate at the final decision point for these federal challenges?
And A.G. Ellison, I saw you writing those down. As I'd asked the auditor, if you could maybe work with Representative Quam to address the questions and just drop us an email or a note, that would be helpful for everybody just so we can make sure that we're all in the loop on this.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Quam, every single case that we brought against the federal government, we've won. And so we don't have any unsuccessful costs. We've got either a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction in all of the 11 cases that I've had to file since January 20th. So we don't have any, that would be zero. In terms of federal challenges, would you like me to complete my answer?
Please proceed.
In terms of federal challenges, the remarkable thing about these challenges is that I would like to think that we're winning because we have such awesome lawyers, but the real truth is that the government is acting, federal government's acting quite outside of the law. And based on the common law ultra vires challenges, the Administrative Procedures Act, the Constitution, even judges from judges that have been Republican appointees have ruled in our favor consistently.
Representative Quam, brief follow-up before we move on?
Yes. I'm sorry I didn't make it clear. I'm not curious about the last two,
okay,
3 months.
Okay.
I'm talking about history. That's why I asked about the annual cost.
Yeah.
So I know that there were previous ones of which weren't successful because you've been in there for years. So offline, you can go back and look at the history of your office and be able to answer the question.
AG Ellison, very briefly, or you want to move on?
I'm not aware.
Do some follow-up offline.
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Chair. I'm not aware of any unsuccessful challenges to federal statutes. I just don't. None come to mind now. And then I think your first question was outside counsel. Is that right? So we could follow up with that. We generally don't use outside counsel. We use outside counsel in the case we have involving ExxonMobil. We have outside counsel that we use in the Jewel matter. But we also have several Minnesota AG lawyers working on the same file. So we can prorate those. It's somewhat of a rare occurrence that we do that. And then in several of our cases that we brought outside counsel, they didn't charge us anything at all. So we'll get that back to you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Quorum. We're happy to work with you.
Thank you very much. We'll now move on to Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, AG Ellison, for being here. I first just want to say thank you for all the work that you and your office does. I mean, clearly, it's you're helping support the people of Minnesota, every county, helping to support our county prosecutors, and then going after, you know, industries that affect so many of us. So thank you for that. Just a question kind of relating to just a conversation we had with the state auditor about vacancies.
Right.
And in particular, you know, some challenges of competing with the private sector. And so I'm wondering, has your office experienced any difficulty in that way?
AG Ellison.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Jones, we've been fortunate in that anytime people do move to another office, we're able to fill it pretty, you know, we're able to fill our vacancies. But the truth is often at this tremendous sacrifice to the people who are taking the jobs. I mean, people sometimes have accepted jobs from us when at a reduction of pay, and that means that they might come in, but then, you know, it's hard to keep them once the demands of family, you know, and, you know, we don't want our lawyers to take a vow of poverty, you know, because they want to serve the public interest. We'd like them to be able to get at least as well compensated as they would at Hennepin or Ramsey County. And we don't expect to keep up with the U.S. Attorney's Office and certainly not the private sector, but in order to keep talent, in order to maintain institutional memory, it's important to have competitive pay for workers.
Representative Jones, anything further? Okay. Members, in the interest of time, we've got bills still to hear. We've got Representative Davis and Representative Anderson. We'll encourage expediency, and we can go to Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Can you just I'm going to put two questions in the one here. Just very briefly tell us about your Medicaid fraud unit, control unit, and then roughly how much money have they uncovered, a ballpark figure, if you could give us that since you've been in office.
AG Ellison.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Thank you for giving me a chance to talk about a Medicaid fraud unit. We are enormously proud of it. The Medicaid fraud unit pays for itself through criminal restitution and civil recoveries. It wins. The unit's budget is about $5 million per year, and of that, the state pays only 25%, and we have recovered $53,237,300.35. And so, and that's between 2029 and 2024. And if you like, we could provide that in an email or a memo.
Representative Davis, anything further?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for that information. Yes, I would love to get that in an email. And then to my next question, I'm concerned about perhaps Medicaid fraud that we haven't caught yet or that is being done currently as we speak. So what can we do? What are your suggestions for us as legislators? What can we do to help, you know, keep it from happening on the front end?
Mr. Chairman, this is a great question. It's somewhat philosophical, and I'll agree to that. I'll admit to that. But my thought is deploying more people at the investigative level will probably be the most effective way to ensure the importance of the program. The other thing is we've got to talk about the importance of Medicaid to vulnerable people who don't have any health care. Because what I say is that every time you steal from Medicaid, you're eroding the public support for Medicaid. And so this is a crime. It's a serious crime. It's got to be punished. I would say that, yes, penalties, longer sentences do have an effect, but most people who commit crimes don't think they're getting caught. It has something to do with criminal mentality. So what we got to do is increase the certainty that you will get caught. And so that's what I would do. I'd put more money into investigation. And as you know, anybody who's watched Law and Order knows that you got the police and you got the prosecutors. We're the prosecutors. We also do have investigative staff, but most of the work that we do is the prosecutions we do is based on investigations that happen, that's at least start in the Department of Human Services. So that would be my advice, Representative, and thank you for your question because it's critically important.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Attorney General.
Thank you. All right, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for being here, Mr. Attorney General.
Certainly,
just a quick question. You mentioned the right to repair lawsuit you joined with Illinois against John Deere.
Right.
And just a kind of a novice legal question. Since Minnesota, under current statute, farm equipment is exempt from right to repair, what's the standing of Minnesota joining that lawsuit?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a significant and concrete injury to our state. Because, as you know, under the Minnesota state statute, the attorney general is allowed to vindicate the rights of Minnesota consumers. And our argument is based on consumer protection laws and on antitrust laws that that these right to repair laws are not lawful and they're too restrictive. And so, yeah, we have substantial standing. We believe that this case is moving forward and we have no worries about maintaining our lawsuit based on issue of standing.
Representative Anderson, anything further? Okay, we will now move to Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Attorney General. So Representative Davis asked the largest part of my question about Medicaid fraud. It is also part of your budget request.
Yes.
So I want to make sure that we understand fully the need for this additional resource in your office, but also one of the things that we've heard about the best way that we can prevent this fraud is to make sure we have adequate line staff doing the work so that they can see patterns and see the criminal activity and stop it before it gets to the expensive part of prosecution. So we heard that, and we also heard, I just want to make sure that everyone heard your comment that this is a real criminal enterprise. These are people who are very greedy and who think they'll never get caught. And so criminals are going to do criminal behavior. But if you could please help us understand your budget request, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Attorney A.G. Ellison, if you would also put the number so that everybody in the that's watching online could also understand the budget ask.
Where is it? Okay. So our request would be $390,000. And as I noted before, there's a substantial federal match for the program. I'm just like, you know, three-fourths of the money is federal money. We put up 25%. The federal agency that sort of administers the Medicaid program does regular assessments of state Medicaid fraud programs like ours. And they came to us and said, we think you're understaffed. And so we had formulated a request to you to try to bring us in line with what that federal agency believes we should have in terms of personnel. And so that is the genesis of our request. I can tell you that you are right. Trying to prevent fraud before it starts is very important. And you're also right that, you know, people who commit crimes are amazingly imaginative. I mean, think about what they could do if they thought about doing what was right. But yeah, it's that's sort of the genesis of our request. And but invariably, you're going to get people who you've got to prosecute. And I just want to let the committee know, we're clear the difference between people who make mistakes, people who are committing fraud deliberately. Some are small operations, some are big. And some do their fraud in connection with other enterprises. We had to pursue a nursing home, which relied on Medicaid dollars, but also ended up in a lot of medical neglect. I believe it was out of Aiken County. I think it was Golden Shores was a few years back. And so we do have to prosecute these people at some point, but some of them get so far gone, and some of them have a mix of Medicaid fraud and medical neglect and other sort of abuses. So thank you for your question. I hope I covered it.
Thank you, A.G. Ellison. Chair Cleburne, anything?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah. By all means, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, I'm Laura Sales. I'm the Director of Government Relations. I was just going to add that the request is for 9 staff, which would be 1 attorney and 7 investigators, and then 1 support staff to help with that new work.
Thank you very much.
But, Mr. Chairman, you're only going to pay for a few of them.
Correct. That's the 390.
Yeah, yeah.
And
Chair Cleburne.
Yeah, that was my point, that this is a really good bang for our buck, so to speak, because 75% of that expense would be paid by our federal tax dollars, bringing those home to work for our citizens. Is that correct?
Thank you, Representative.
A.G. Ellison, thanks for being here this morning. I'm sure as Chair Cleburne and I begin to build our finance bill, we'll be talking with you more as we proceed. So thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just may I say that if anybody wants to talk offline or get a follow-up, I'm more than happy to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much. Next on deck, we have House File 627. Chair Torkelson, and even though you are an ex officio on this committee, I will still move your bill to come before the House, and we will be our committee, and we'll be laying House File 627 over. Chair Torkelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing File 627 this morning. It actually is a simple little bill. Puts into statute that a lead of a committee can request a fiscal note similar to the fashion that a committee chair can request a fiscal note.
Members, I will say, having been both chair and lead, that having the access for leads to be able to request fiscal notes is quite helpful. I will move on to member questions. That many. Chair Cleburne, any words?
Thank you. I appreciate this, and I always think that policy should be driven without regard to who's in control of the speakership at this moment in the House. And if I were in this position of serving as minority, I might be thinking about this as well. But do you have any idea how many extra fiscal notes this will be?
Representative Torkelson.
No, I don't have an estimate. Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Cleburne.
I was just wondering if we then would know the appropriation for this, but it's...
Yeah, and I, as I understand it, it will be fairly infrequent, and I don't know that we've had a sound fiscal note for this, but I believe it's pretty close to de minimis. If Ms. Roberts may know that, yes, no? Chair Torkelson, do you have an inkling?
I do not have it in front of me.
Okay.
A number floating around, and it was in the
Ms. Roberts.
Small thousands.
Yeah. Ms. Roberts is going to be making her way to the testifier's table.
That's good.
And once again, speaking as previous lead on this committee, it's not that frequent that by the time a bill hits our committee, we're going to need the lead to be able to get a fiscal note, but there are some times where it would be quite helpful. So, Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members, Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff. I have not requested a fiscal note on this bill. I think our discussion with amongst the fiscal analysts is that we did not think this would have a large impact. I can only speak from my experience, but I think from the general practice for fiscal analysts is that we will request a fiscal note for any member that requests a fiscal note for their bill. And we also look ahead for the committee to see which bills are coming to the committee, so we request fiscal notes in advance. The practice has always been that the chair of Ways and Means has sort of delegated that authority to the fiscal staff so that the chair Ways and Means and the chair of the committees don't have to manage that process and allow the fiscal staff to do that on their behalf. So we do not expect that there would be a big impact.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Appreciate that. I can see from the corner of my eye, Chair Cleaborn.
No, thank you very much. That's all I need. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the fiscal staff that always does a fine job. The effort of this is really just to continue the free flow of information through our committee structure and allow leads to make sure that those fiscal notes are requested, and it would just improve the flow of information, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. And with that, House File 627 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next on the agenda, we have House File 474. We are hearing this informationally. Representative Long, thank you for coming before the committee. Please, I will move your bill to come before the committee, and we will be doing this informationally as stated, because I believe the bill is actually in possession of
Capital
another
investment.
Committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. So this is a bipartisan bill regarding the statues that Minnesota sends to Congress. Each state gets two statues to send them. Minnesota's current two statues are Maria Sanford, which was installed in 1958, and Henry Maurer Rice, which was installed in 1916. Like Minnesota, many states have chosen to submit one civic leader and one political leader. So, for example, Kansas sends Amelia Earhart and Dwight Eisenhower. California has sent Father Junipero Serra and Ronald Reagan. Mr. Maurer Rice was an early leader in our state in helping facilitate statehood, and he was one of its first two U.S. senators. But there's been more than a century since we have updated our statue. And since Mr. Maurer Rice's statue was sent, Minnesotans have accomplished quite a bit on the national stage. And I believe that the Minnesotan who's had the greatest impact on national politics in that time is Hubert Humphrey. As folks know, Humphrey was the Vice President of the United States from 1965 to 1969 under President Johnson, was a Democratic standard bearer for President in 1968, served for 23 years in the U.S. Senate, and his accomplishments included the Civil Rights Act of 1964, proposing Medicare and the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Humphrey was always bipartisan in his efforts on legislative goals, and often his biggest antagonists were in his own party, particularly on civil rights. So all that the DE amendment that we are informationally hearing today would do is to allow for the state to collect private donations to pay for a new statue to be made. It would be a recast of the statue that is currently on the Capitol grounds here, and then for that to be shipped to D.C., and to ship the existing statue of Mr. Maurer Rice back to Minnesota to be displayed in Rice County. And so I believe this is the time to update our statue in D.C. and to reflect the history that's transpired since 1916. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. And members, we're not moving the D.E. because this is informationally. It'll be moved in a separate committee. So we will then have the statute for the statue in the form that the author would like when that comes. This may be included in our finance bill. That's why we wanted to hear it here. Members, questions? Seeing none, Representative Long, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the consideration for including in the omnibus and appreciate the support.
Thank you very much. Okay, we are now going to move on to House File 361. Chair Cleaborn will be gathering your, you're going to go to the testifier table? Okay. House File 361, and that referral is going to be to Ways and Means. We're going to lay it over instead for possible inclusion. Chair Cleaborn, if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And the reason I've changed the House File 361 is intended to be a vehicle bill that will go to Ways and Means. The reason I'm laying it over today is because there is still discussion about what the actual contents of this bill should be. So I'm going to present it in the form that we are thinking about at this moment. There is a DE1. But then I would like to work with Chair Nash and Representative Schultz to make sure that the bill is in the form that we need it to actually be in before we move it out.
Chair Cleaver moves the DE1. to put the bill in the form that you would like. Members, all any questions? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? The DE1 is adopted. Please proceed to your bill as amended.
Thank you very much. This bill is about the capital improvements on the Capitol Mall. And in 2023, we passed legislation that had a termination date of December 31st of last year. Some of the work has not yet been completed. And so this bill, as it is amended, would allow us to specifically do the items that have not been completed and to appropriate the money for that work. So it would be $350,000 to complete the Tribal Plaza, which would include purchasing of the pavers, installing the plants at the bases of the flagpoles, and installing trees north of the flags, and putting signage out to explain each of the flags. And then you'll see in the second section, there's $350,000 for additional trees for the complex mall, benches along the central corridor of the upper mall and along Aurora Plaza, and then wayfinding, which means signage, so that when people come to the Capitol, they can actually find their way around the Capitol. And this would be a one-time appropriation that would expire in 2027. So that's what the DE actually does, and I would prefer to get more agreement with Representative Schultz and with Chair Nash before moving the bill.
All right, members, to the bill as amended. Questions? Saw a little movement. I thought somebody want to testify. Okay. Seeing no questions, Chair Cleburne.
I would just ask that we lay this bill over at this moment for possible inclusion.
All right. With that, House File 361 is laid over. Okay. We will now move on to a walkthrough of House File 1837. Okay. Chair Cleburne.
Thank you very much, Chair Nash. What I would like to do is just kind of let the committee members, so I would move the DE2, please.
The chair moves the DE2.
And then I would just kind of like to go through it quickly, if Mr. Sullivan would come forward. I'm going to just say what the bills are that we've included in a mutual agreement with Chair Nash, and then ask Mr. Sullivan to walk through the bill as it's actually written.
Yep. So, Chair Cleburne.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Davis, House File 2 includes Section 2, 5, and 6. There was a little bit of modification of the language. We have included Representative Robbins' bill 23 as it was amended on the House floor. This has to do with modifying whistleblower protections. We've included Representative Quam's House File 289 as amended on the floor, which is the SAVI program, which I understand was his very first piece of legislation. We've included Representative Long's House File 474, which is the wording for the statutory hall, but that will be in the finance bill. I think I have that wrong. That's in the finance bill. Apologies, that's incorrect. We've included the Myers State Fossil Bill, which was House File 791. We've included Chair Nash's House File 927 and House File 1059, which are legislative commissions that have been removed, and House File 1060 as well. House File 1062, also the Driver Vehicle Systems Oversight, has been repealed. That's Chair Nash. We are including the changes to the Compensation Council that was provided by the LCC, House File 1151. We've included House File 1172, which is the Myers bill for the Constellation. We've included House File 1240, which are modifications to the legislative auditor. We've included Representative Davis, House File 1809, which is a change to the debt report date. My own bill, 1836, which made changes to the government data practices law. This bill, 1837, as amended, as the vehicle for the state government policy bill. House File 1910, which was also a legislative coordinating commission change. We've included Representative Paul Anderson's 1956 for the threshold on the municipal liquor auditor requirements, Representative Howard's Bill 2020, which is the CGIP policy. We've modified state contract language, including House File 2232. And we have added the Office of Administrative Hearings Bill, which was House File 2451. Changes to the Joint Legislative Studies provision, House File 2514. Legislative definition of joint offices, House File 2515. State personnel management provisions that were introduced in the governor's bill, but we removed Section 7, and that was House File 2713. And then the governor's bill, finance bill, House File 2783, but we've included Sections 5, 7, and 10 out of the policy provisions of that bill only. And that is to let the committee know what's in here, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Sullivan, if you'd like to walk through the changes as detail as needed, please do so.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I'll be walking through the amendment. It's coded in the top right corner, H1837DE2. Chair Cleavorn just gave a list of the bills that are included, and you've all seen the language previously, so I won't spend much time on each section. I'll just note which bills they tie back to. I will... however, spend a little time identifying the changes that Chair Cleavorn mentioned as we go through the amendment. So starting on page 1, Section 1, State Fossil, this is Representative Myers, House Call 791. Section 2, Designating State Constellation, is also Representative Myers, House File 1172. Chair Cleavorn mentioned the requests by the LCC that are incorporated. The first one is Section 3 on the bottom of page 1. It's from Chair Cleavorn's House File 1910. Moving on then to page 2, sections 4 and 5 are also LCC requested changes from Chair Cleavorn's House File 2515 and 2514. Then beginning on the bottom of page 2, section 6, staff compensation. This is a series of sections requested by the Office of the Legislative Auditor in Representative Quam's House File 1240. Those continue through all of page 3 and onto the top of page 4. And then Section 9, contracts, on page 4, this is from Representative Cleavorn's House File 2232. This was an amendment, an oral amendment adopted in committee to exempt the State Board of Investment contracts from certain new prohibited contract provisions that we'll see later in the bill that were also included in House File 2232. Then Section 10, procedure when data is not accurate or complete. This is from Chair Cleavorn's House File 1836. Moving then to the bottom of page 5, Section 11, data sharing. This is from Chair Cleavorn's House File 2783 and allows state agencies to share non-public data when they suspect that fraud has been committed against public programs. Then beginning on page 6, about halfway down, section 12, this begins a series of sections from Chair Cleavorn's House File 2451. These are changes requested by the Office of Administrative Hearings, which, if this language were enacted, would be renamed the Court of Administrative Hearings. Those sections continue through all of page 7 and all of page 8, where agencies would now have the opportunity to request remand of an OAH finding in a contested case hearing. Then on page 9, at the top of that page, section 17, this is also from Chair Cleavorn's House File 2783, the governor's finance bill, and it would allow state agencies to withhold payments to recipients of state funds when suspected fraud occurs. Then on the bottom of page 10, section 18, reporting alleged misuse of public resources or data. This is an expanded duty to report issues, suspected wrongdoing to the legislative auditor. It's also from Representative Quam's House File 1240. Then on top of page 11, section 9, this is from Vice Chair Davis's House File 2, organization charts posted, requiring agencies to... requiring agencies to post their organization charts on their websites. The language previously in House File 2 said that agencies had to prominently post this information. The language was changed in this amendment on page 11.7 to say they must clearly post their org charts. Then section 20, Savvy Program, is Representative Quam's House File 289.
Then continuing on to page 12, section 21, the bottom of that page, this is from Chair Nash's House File 1151. These are the changes to the Compensation Council, the timing of their recommendations for judicial salaries. And that continues on to page 13, section 22, the prohibition on ex parte communications. This language, as Chair Cleborn mentioned, is modified here in this DE. The new language is on 13.21 to 13.23. It provides that the this prohibition does not apply to council members who are attorneys when they're communicating with an agency head, judge, or justice as necessary to represent their client. In the bottom of page 13, section 23 is also from Representative Quam Savvy Bill, House File 289. Then on page 14, you get the series of sections that were from House File 1837, this bill as introduced and carried by Chair Cleborn. These are changes requested by the Department of Administration. Sections 24 and 25 on page 14, section 26 on page 15, section 27 on page 16, and then there are a couple of sections later, but on section 17, page 17, we switch back to Vice Chair Davis's House File 2, Section 28, reporting of violations. This has to do with now a requirement that state employees report suspected violations of state grant-making laws or rules. Instead of reporting immediately, as in House File 2 on 17.9, the report would need to be made promptly. And the report could be made to the employee's manager. So if they have a manager instead of a supervisor, that's who they could report to. And then there's a corresponding change on 17.12 to say if the employee reports to their supervisor, manager, or commissioner, then the person they report to needs to forward that information to the legislative auditor. Bottom of page 17, section 29, this is also from Vice Chair Davis's House File 2. Has to do with state grant agreements between the state and the grantee. There's a change on page 18, on 18.9. Vice Chair Davis's House File 2 required state grant agreements to require the grantee to clearly post certain information on their website. And now there's new language on 18.9 that would say, as determined by the commissioner, the grant agreements must require this information. So providing some discretion to the Commissioner of Administration. And on page 18, halfway down the page, section 30, this is from Chair Cleborn's House File 2232, also a request from the Department of Administration providing that certain terms in state procurement contracts would be unenforceable and void. Moving on to page 19, then, the top of that page, section 31, we're back to Chair Cleborn's House File 1837. Additional recommendations or requests from the Department of Administration. Those continue on the rest of page 19, all of pages 20, 21, and the top of 22. Then about a quarter of the way down on page 22, section 35, generally, this is from Vice Chair Davis's House File 1809. It modifies the timing of an annual report from Minnesota Management and Budget to the legislature regarding debt that state agencies have determined is uncollectible. Then on page 23, at the top of the page, section 36, this is from Representative Howard's House File 2020, providing eligibility for dependents of certain retired state employees to participate in CGIP. If the retired state employee loses their eligibility for CGIP for certain reasons. On to page 24, the top of that page, the insulin repayment account, section 37, is from Chair Cleborn's House File 2783. Then moving down to the definition of fraud in section 38, the bottom of page 24, and the definition of misuse. As Chair Cleborn mentioned, these are from Representative Robbins' House File 23 as amended and passed off the House floor. That language continues through all of page 25 and the top of page 26. And then section 42, the audited financial statements. This is Representative Anderson's House File 1956 regarding municipal liquor stores. Section 43 is a revisor instruction from House File 2451 to change OAH to CAH, Court of Administrative Hearings, throughout statute where those terms appear. The repealer, these coincide with other bills that are incorporated and that I've mentioned previously, with the exception of the Legislative Commission's Subdivision 1. These are Chair Nash's bills, House Files 927, 1059, 1060, and 1062. And then Article 2 contains all of the state personnel management sections. There are 30 or so of those, so they're in their separate article to keep those sections together. These are all from Chair Cleaborn's House File 2713. As she mentioned, though, minus Section 7, which modified the ability of state employees to request that MMB investigate the duties of positions in the classified service. So in my bill summary for the DE2, I do provide more information about what I feel are the significant provisions in this article and the provisions that are repealed at the end. So if you have any questions about those, please feel free to reach out to me. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've reached the end of the DE2.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. And I'll just say before we move to questions that thanks to Chair Cleaborn, Ms. Rudolph, Mr. Grunhauser, we spent some time putting these together, and it went well. So, members, questions? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And something that just occurred to me that was kind of small is regarding the organizational charts posted. There's no timing aspect to that. I'm wondering if we could add just like that this occurs on an annual basis or something, because otherwise I worry that.
Representative Jones, you want to give us a
section? Yes, it's on 11.6.
Mr. Sullivan, you want to go back to the testifiers table or Chair Cleaborn?
Thank you, Chair Nash and Representative Jones. This language has been, I appreciate it, right? I really appreciate what you're saying. This would be a question that Chair Nash and I would probably have to negotiate to make that change. Some of these these would be for state agencies. So I don't know how frequently the agencies actually change their organizational chart with staffing or not staffing. Lead Nash?
Yeah, I would ask Mr. Sullivan, is an inclusion of a defined time frame necessary for this?
Mr. Chair and members, it's necessary, I guess, only if the legislature feels that without that language, the agencies would not update that information as needed.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the language is pretty clear that they're to keep their organizational charts there. I think it would be something that we could speak to them about and let them know our intent and then see how it goes. And if it doesn't happen, then that would be an opportunity for us to change it in future years.
And Madam Chair, I would tend to agree. Any further questions? Once, twice. Okay. Chair Cleaborn, if you'd like to speak to... Oh, that's right. We have testifiers today.
We do.
I keep forgetting we have testifiers today and not... Okay. And to the testifiers, we have a little bit of time, but not let's not love the bill too much. So we have Deputy Commissioner Raytan is not here.
There she is.
There she is. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I was looking for movement. I didn't see you behind the pillar. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair Nash and Chair Cleaborn and committee members. For the record, I'm Britta Raytan, Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to provide very brief testimony on the committee's policy omnibus bill. We appreciate the inclusion of the provision allowing state agencies to withhold payments to a program participant where there is a credible allegation of fraud. This is an important piece of the governor's anti-fraud package that would provide the state with an important tool to safeguard public funds. So thank you for that. We also are appreciative of the inclusion of our proposals that modernize and update Chapter 43A language related to state personnel management, and to amend the deadline for the uncollectible debt report, which will allow MMB staff sufficient time with the data to compile the report. Thank you, and we look forward to working with you as this bill progresses, and that completes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Devin Bruce. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. To get to it, we would like to first express our support for the inclusions of Article 1, Sections 11, 17, and 18 that clarifies and strengthens the authority for data sharing provisions among agencies, as well as the ability, clearer ability to withhold payments from folks who are under investigation for credible allegations of fraud. For our members who are overseeing these grants and part of the OIG's office, there's always been unclear authority under which they can withhold payments and are subject to a lawsuit. So this provides a lot more comfort for that. We would also like to voice our strong support for the inclusion of the expanded whistleblower protections for unclassified state employees in Section 41 of Article 1, and specifically thank Representative Robbins, Representative Pinto, and everybody here who supported the bill as it passed off the floor. We did not get to express our thanks for that because it was added on the floor as an amendment. In the future, we hope to also expand some of these protections to our local government folks, but we see that there's not a broad agreement for that right now, and we're trying to address things at the state level. So we greatly appreciate the inclusion there. Two things that we want to highlight where we have several areas of concern that we've also raised with MMB is the policy language proposed by under Article 2, Sections 11 and 12, which expands the authority to make temporary and emergency appointments. With hundreds of our employees being laid off this week, it doesn't feel like the right time to be expanding the authority, not just for the number of days and time period, but also under which they can be appointed for those short terms. So we would express our strong opposition to those points, and we'd be happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Members, questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Bruce. Next, we will have Deputy Commissioner Christensen. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Stacey Christensen, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. I will be brief. Thank you to the chairs and members for hearing our policy proposals this session, including most of those on the bill before you today. The policy updates in House File 1837 will maintain federal conformity with the STAR program, better coordinate report dates, and generally update department statutes and provide for effective data sharing. Additionally, we encourage the committee to add admins grants management proposals into the bill or the omnibus budget bill. As mentioned in earlier testimony, these changes to current law would strengthen grant administration, among other items, by expanding the suspension and debarment authority to include potential grantees who have engaged or been convicted in serious crimes. Finally, I want to emphasize the department takes its stewardship of public funds seriously and as reflected in earlier testimony, has processes to report and protect against fraud, including responsiveness to employee reports, which we believe are currently effectively coordinated within the OLA reporting process. Again, thank you for including many of our provisions, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Members, questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Okay, thank you very much. Chair Cleavorn, if you would give next steps for the bill that we have before us after we've done our run through here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the adoption of the DE2, please remind me, did we adopt the DE2?
We're doing a run through, so we don't need to do that. I think we'll do that on Thursday.
We'll do it on Thursday.
Yeah,
okay.
That would be my understanding.
I just wanted to make sure I had it right. So, what we will do next is we will take the conversation that we heard today and have a discussion about that to see which pieces we might want to modify or add. And then we will present the DE2 again on Thursday, and we will mark it up with any changes that we have decided as a committee to adopt and accept. And then from there, we would vote it onto the DE2, onto House File 1837, so that 1837, as amended, would move out of committee as our policy bill to the floor.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. Members, any questions relative to the processes that we'll be taking on Thursday? Chatty bunch this morning. Okay. Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. Once again, thanks to you and our staff members for putting this together. We're going to be putting the finance bill together, and hopefully that will go as well as this did. So, members, watch your inbox. Things will be moving quickly. And with that, we are adjourned.